Welcome back to Neuroconversant Leadership, where we talk about effective communication in the STEM workplace. I'm Jeremy Doran, and I help engineers, doctors, and scientists become great leaders. Have you ever wondered how you can be more convincing? Whether you're selling a product or pitching an idea, being persuasive is a very valuable skill. Luckily, today's guest, Carlos Alvarenga, just published a book on the topic, and the book's called The Rules of Persuasion. Carlos, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here with you and all your listeners.
It's very exciting. I've looked through your webpage, and a lot of things you talk about are similar to what we talk about here on this podcast. Can you just give everyone a little bit of background of what it is that you do?
Sure. So I'm currently what I call independent researcher, writer, and coach. And that means that I research and write not as part of an institution, but on my own. And so my focus is language in many different ways. And I'm also currently doing a PhD in language and rhetoric at the University of Maryland. Before this, I had a long career as a management consultant at Accenture and EY. And before that, so I spent a lot of time with technologists. And before that, I originally way back after undergrad, I was a journalist. So journalist, consultant, and now writer and researcher.
That is quite the journey.
It is, but I used to joke when I was a consultant, I don't know what my next job is. I just know what my last job is. That's right. And so I'm fortunate enough to be able to do that for a little.
Nice. So can you tell us a little bit more about your book, The Rules of Persuasion?
Yeah, so the book goes back a few years when I started volunteering with nonprofit through a website that matches nonprofit CEOs and founders with people who want to help and donate their time. And I wanted to donate my time. And the very first project, I was matched with a gentleman, very senior gentleman, chairman of an international relief agency, whose project went something like, help, I'm boring. I can't do a sprint. I'm a terrible communicator. My team has had it, and they're forcing me to get help. And so I met him on Zoom, and he kept talking about persuasion and what it helped with persuasion, being a persuasive speaker. So I ordered a few books from Amazon on persuasion. And when I read them, I realized they really weren't about persuasion. They were about influence or about, in some cases, almost manipulation or negotiation or sales, a lot of things, but they didn't really address the word itself. And they didn't explain exactly what persuasion is or how does it work. And so I went back to a book I read as an undergraduate called The Rhetoric by the philosopher Aristotle, which is about persuasion. And I made a PowerPoint deck from the book. And I said to this gentleman, let's go through this deck. I think we'll benefit from the concepts. And this is a good way to start your coaching. And he did. It was a great project. He invited me for a second project about a hospital was launching. Fast forward a year, I'd done a dozen of these coaching projects, all working on and refining the explanation of Aristotle's book. My wife said, you should write this down. I think you've done a good job of updating it for a modern audience. I did. I sold the book. My agent sold it, actually, the technical. And then the book came out at the end of last year.
Congratulations. It's no small task writing a book.
No small task. 3 years of research, writing, and then waiting for the publishing process to take its course, which is often slow.
So when you are coaching, who are typical clients of yours?
So the originally it was all nonprofit work, right? So we're founders and CEOs of nonprofits. Since the book came out, I've been contacted by for-profit and startup CEOs who came across the book and said, hey, can you teach me to do what you write about? And the answer is yes. And so I've been teaching people the book in essence, and sort of how to put the ideas in the book. By the way, there is a whole chapter in methodology and how to do it, as you know, because you're a coach. Sometimes people want sort of personal help in putting the ideas to work. So I've now just been through word of mouth and receiving requests to coach people on the ideas that are in the book, which has been really interesting.
That is. And a lot of times just having a person to bounce ideas off of and get different perspectives as you go is incredibly valuable. So why is it that people are reaching out to you about the topic of persuasion? Is it communication in general or how to be more persuasive, and why are they needing that? Are there certain things they're trying to accomplish?
Well, it goes back to something. I've been doing some talks recently, and I have a talk, a slide at the beginning of my talk, and I say, the picture is of a man playing the piano on stage. And I say, now, imagine that you're trying to become an executive or a CEO or a founder or whatever it is you're trying to achieve. And people through all the interviews, all the selection boards, and they say, you're doing great. There's only one step left. I need you to go on stage and just play something. Anything you like. I mean, Brahms, Mozart, Bach, we don't care. A little like Beethoven, just knock yourself out. And you go, wait a minute, I've never had pianist. It doesn't matter because everybody must fit the piano to become an executive in this company. It sounds silly, but yet that's exactly what I find is the case with persuasion, right? We considered a critical leadership skill, a critical skill in every field of endeavor, and yet we don't study it, we don't learn it, it's not taught in schools. It used a long time ago, but it isn't anymore. So here we have this strange phenomenon, which is this skill is critical to my success, and yet I've never been taught it. And as I say to people I coach, it's very hard to be citizen you can't define. So I always start with the definition. It's really Aristotle's definition. And then having worked from the definition to what, how persuasion operates, which I say in my book, and it's a point that I always try to make, is that people have this mistaken impression that persuasion is quote unquote a soft skill or some undefined thing or some innate characteristic. It isn't, right? The metaphors in the book is persuasion is chemistry with language. And so if you understand the chemistry, It's actually highly predictable. It works in very strict ways. And so what the book lays out is really the chemistry behind persuasion.
So what is the definition of persuasion then?
The definition I work with is persuasion is a demonstration that something is true or appears to be true. Full stop. And so it has many implications, this definition. The first from being, I don't persuade you, truth or its appearance. Persuade you. Right? Assuming you're a rational person, my job is to get you to believe this thing is true, and then persuasion follows automatically from that. And so that's the job of the communicator, is to get you to believe.
That sounds so simple, but obviously you had to write a book on it that's got multiple steps, so I'm guessing it's not as simple as it sounds.
Sometimes it is, right? Sometimes it is. In the book, what I lay out is Aristotle in his book says there are only three modes of persuasion. There is the character of the speaker, which can be a person, school, an army, country, right, an institution. There are the arguments presented, so logic, proofs, evidence, those kinds of things, but the hard stuff, quote unquote. And there's the emotion that the audience feels as they're being spoken to. So now the strange thing about Aristotle is that the more obvious something was, the less he explains it. And so for him, this is so obvious that he sort of states it and then moves on to other more complicated things. And so you may have heard this called ethos, pathos, logos, when it comes from this text. And my book was an attempt to explain, well, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by character? What do you mean by argument? What do you mean by emotion? And then, like I said, tell me exactly what happens when someone is persuaded. So in my book, what I say is that we can take character and break it into seven parts. We can take argument and break seven parts. We can take emotion and break them into seven parts. These 21 parts, right, where I see in the book is the best way to understand them is to go back to high school chemistry, which you'll appreciate, and think of them as the periodic table of persuasion.
Oh,
every
nice.
Average ever created, and I've looked at thousands. Person to person to God, God to person, God to God, is some combination of these 21 elements. And so sometimes you only use one, sometimes you use two, sometimes you use three, right? And so especially to your audience, will hopefully appreciate this metaphor that if you understand that chemistry, you can take apart any message, and you can also get very good at building messages. So great communicators are chemists of language, I always say.
And there are some people who I feel are just lend themselves to be incredible. Something about the way they carry themselves or present themselves. Some people just seem credible and honest, whereas some people don't always seem that way right off the bat. Is that innate, or are there things people can do to build on that?
It's both. And so like anything in persuasion, there are people who are innately good at this. They never have to be taught this somehow. It's like music, like there are people who are playing the piano when they're four. And so they just have to have that gift. Of course, even if you have the gift, technique makes it better, right? And so this is a, persuasion is a word in the Aristotle text that he calls a techne. But techne has no counterpart in English. we translate it as art sometimes, but it isn't really art. It's not practical art or art with purpose. And so what I find is that, yes, I've seen lots of famous and not so famous people who are close in a room and watch them communicate. And it's clear that they had just an innate talent, that the chemistry is built in, so to speak, right? But other people have learned it and have become very good through practice, trial and error, right? And just repetition. And they become great chemists in the classroom, so to speak, right? Through experimentation and through work. So you can get great both ways, and the person who has both is the most effective.
I like it. One of the things that you hint at on your webpage and to cover the book is that it can go too far. What happens when it goes too far?
Yeah. So what I also say is this, right? Chemistry is amoral. So, my wife's a scientist, and I we talk about full time that the building blocks of chemistry can be used to make medicine, or they can be used to make poison, right? And the same thing is true of language. I can save you with language. I can play you with language. And so there's a chapter in the book that looks at the markers of language being used to poison a society. And I picked 9 out of a whole bunch. And I use the Nazi language, right, as my case study. And I say these 9 markers that we look at in their language are evident in American society today, which is evidence that someone's trying to poison us with language. And so there is this, quote unquote, dark side of persuasion, or the corrupt side is a better term, where someone is taking this chemistry and is using it for corrupt purposes. And I think that one reason I wrote the book, as I joke, is that it's a kind of vaccine. It's a kind of inoculation. If you understand what's being presented to you, it's much easier to recognize good from bad.
So we can use this book to help interpret what politicians are telling us?
Absolutely. And there are very specific examples of the book where I look at and I discuss a political technique or the way in which people talk about each other in politics to say, well, this is exactly what's going on. And look at the counterpart in this other place and time. You'll see that the same thing that's going on, just different words in a different language.
So I'm going to recommend right now that everyone reads this book before listening to debates and voting in November.
We're about to enter the Super Bowl of persuasion, which happens in America every 4 years. And it was one reason I wanted to get the book out before the campaign season.
And it's a long Super Bowl. It's going to go on for months and months now.
I need time to read my book.
The analogy that I use, going back to the analogy you used earlier, is it is like engineers were hired as if they were really good at pottery. They make beautiful plates and cups, and everything is beautiful and durable. And they get hired, and then a couple of years later, someone says to them, "You're so good at making the dishes that food goes onto. We now want you to be a chef." No. And you just spent 10,000 hours learning to be really good at pottery, and now all of a sudden they're saying, "You're a chef now." And that's what happens when people become managers. Or they move up in the organization and all of a sudden they need to start talking to venture capitalists to get funding. It's a totally different skill set. So I am very happy that you were there to help make that transition.
Right. You're right. And what is common across all the profiles, by the way, whether they're, for example, I'm working with a startup, a founder of a nonprofit who was a doctor her whole life. So she was a technical scientific person who now finds herself in the startup role. So this time you have that as well. But one thing that is common to almost everyone I've ever coached is this, Jeremy, and that is, I said that persuasion has these 3 modes, right? So I say, think of it as a ship with 3 masts. What I find is that almost always on day 1, I find a ship with only 1 sail, and it's called argument. And so they have facts and logic and PowerPoints and all these charts and spreadsheets. And that sail is pretty tired. It's doing all the work. And so when I go character, the sail is rolled up nice and tight. When I talk about emotion, it's rolled up nice and tight. And I think this is even worse of the case with STEM-ish people because they're often not comfortable in those spaces. And but it is almost universal that the first thing we do is to say, look, let's unfurl the other 2 sails they can help move the boat along. Going to go a lot faster and going to give this argument, say, a little bit of a break because it's been beat up, right, after all this time doing its job. So sometimes just simple as that is to talk through and say, what part of your story, of these seven elements that describe who you are, can we use to make you more persuasive? And so many people have been told you shouldn't be part of the story, which is wrong. In fact, Aristotle says, of the three modes, that's the most important. And I happen to agree with that. And so it can be as simple as, let's just think about who you are and how you can move this boat, you know, ship along a little faster. And then also, but the question I ask all the time is, what do you want me to feel when we finish talking? I'm going to feel something. So if you don't know what it is, you're not in control. So let's talk through what that is. You want me to feel excited, inspired, relieved, right? And it's amazing how many people, even otherwise really accomplished people, when I ask the question, they have never thought about it, right? And so you go, all right, well, let's work that through. Suddenly, we find one thing about you that makes you a little bit more persuasive. We engineer the emotion to be the right one. And all of a sudden, everything begins to fall. So it can be small changes. It's usually not a wholesale reworking of the chemistry. It's adjust the percentage a little bit, add a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and suddenly the formula finds its power, and we're off to the races.
Like stoichiometry.
Yeah. It's funny about how people think there's going to be this big rework, but it really isn't. There's just small things that they're usually lying right in front of us. Right. So you go, it's just right there. Just pick it up and use it and you're going to be great. And lots of examples of small things that suddenly change your entire perception of how someone, of what someone is saying or what was talking to you. Right.
Is it like a light bulb going off sometimes where.
I'll give you a real case, right? So there was this, scientist for a doctor who started a fund, and she did really well in her career, was very successful, was able to retire a little earlier, moved to Hawaii, started a nonprofit to save coral reefs. So I asked her, and she called me and said, I'm doing interviews on the radio and other places, and it's not going so well, so can you help me to fix that? And she said, I'm very analytical, I'm very technical. So when I asked her, let's do a test question. Why'd you start this foundation? And her answer was very specific. Well, I retired early. I was at home. I had nothing to do. I was bored. My kids were gone. And she had all this sort of list of things that were not that interesting, honestly. And I said, you know, it's not going to get anyone to really lean into this story. I want you to try it again. But this time, I want you to find something in your history, your personal key, that explains why we did this. I'm sure it's there. If you just look for her. She struggled for a moment. And then she said, when I was a little girl, I used to watch a show called Jacques Cousteau. It was this French guy who was a diver. And he'd swim around. And I used to watch the show. And I just thought it was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. He'd show us the fish, coral. And when I was a little girl and growing up in Puerto Rico, all I wanted to be was Jacques Cousteau. Of course, life took over. I ended up becoming a doctor. And so the moment I was done with medicine, I moved to Hawaii and I learned how to dive. And I was diving someplace because I wanted to be a fish photographer, but I'm the world's worst fish photographer. All my photos were just tails. And so one day I went out to take pictures and there were no fish. And I look up and I see this coral reef. And I realized the reason I come to this spot over and over again wasn't the fish. It was the reef. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. And at that moment, I decided I would spend the rest of my life protecting. And I said, that's the story, right? That's why you do this. And it was just in her mind instantly, right? And I said, by the way, this nonprofit was born in the mind of that little girl watching Jacques Cousteau. And it came to life that day where there were no fish, but it was this beautiful place, right? And there you go, right? The story is now hers. No one else can tell it. And while the other information was true and correct and useful, that's logically correct, right? That's not what's going to get the audience to be part of this journey with her. And so that's an example of everything was right the first time. It was just the wrong elements in the formula. We added history and personality, and boom, suddenly it works.
I love that. I do talks on using stories to teach and motivate people, and people are so hesitant to talk about themselves if it's a story that makes them look weak or strange or inept. I'm like, those are the good stories. Those are the stories everyone can relate to. And then you take it and you flip it from your personal story to this business idea that you're trying to get across. And people are going to go with you when you can really capture them that way.
And I think you're right. And I think it's important to understand that story is a delivering mechanism, right? Back against the street, I can make medicine for you, but some medicine is given as an injection, some is a pill, some is a liquid, some in the morning, some at night, right? So chemistry is not absolute. It requires certain conditions for it to work. And there are times when a story is the best delivery mechanism, right, for the chemistry. And that's what I tell people. And as a writer, I extend to people, look, all story, you can map them on two axes, and there's change over time. That's what narrative is. How it changed, what changed, right? Over what period of time? And so think about the narrative as this pill, right? Or whatever you want to call it. And then you say, okay, how do I get my information into this form, which people can and are easy to absorb? You know, liquid is very easy because it's medicine typically, worse than an injection. And so, like I say, you think of the PowerPoint charts as the shot, think of the story as the little tasty thing you drink, kind of this. So people will take their medicine much more readily when it's in the format that's easy for them to absorb. And you're right, it's remarkable how people are kept in taught or come to believe that narrative is somehow inferior to charts when it isn't. It predates charts. It's much more powerful. In certain settings, yes, the chart is very important for the technical settings, right? But there's an issue here. I tell people all the time, the more you are persuaded by facts and figures, the farther away you are from persuading the average person. And this is a challenge, especially technical, because they gravitate to that. Like journalists do, for example. People, well, you're leaving the average person behind. In the right setting, that's very important, very effective. But outside of that setting, a specialist, the challenge is very different.
So the story is like the spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down.
That's exactly right. That's how I see it.
And how similar or different is it when you're talking and persuading somebody one-to-one versus a large audience?
It's very different. And in fact, in the book, there's a chapter on the four types of audiences that I discussed. One is ourselves. We have to persuade ourselves things all the time. This is the deliberative audience, right? Should I do this? Should I not do this? The second one is dialectic, which is two people. And dialectic is not debate. Dialectic is you and I are trying honestly to find an answer or solve a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Or it is a defined audience. That means that it's bounded. All listeners of your podcast, everyone watching the Super Bowl, right? And then the last one is what's called a universal audience, which means anyone who could ever receive your message process it. And so these four audiences operate in different ways. And thinking about, okay, am I going to get feedback? Is this dialectic or is it a one way like a commercial is a very different thing. So most often we are dealing with ourselves, which is the most common persuasion settings, or one-to-one. That's the majority. And so getting good at putting the rules to work in those two settings, but and especially in that one-to-one, which is the most critical thing for business people for the most part, or I take professional people is a better word, is highly important because most people are not getting sleep on a daily basis. And most people are not writing for the ages. What they're doing is trying to get one other person to believe.
Yeah. Great. We are starting to wind down because we have limited time for everybody. Are there any topics that you would like to talk about that I haven't asked you about yet?
I'll mention one because I think it's very interesting. It's part of my research. And that's the issue of sentimentality versus emotion, right? And so this is a very subtle concept. And what it means that when a communicator, whether it's a boss or anyone else, wants you to feel something, it should be done in a way that seems genuine. We have this natural aversion to someone manipulating us to try to feel pity or joy or anything else. And it's remarkable how common this is in professional settings. When someone uses a fake emotion or an attempt to create a feeling, and they didn't have to, with a little bit of thought, you could say, what is the real emotion that exists here? And how do I use that instead of trying to find a fake? And I tell people to illustrate this point, they come up Valentine's Day card. The words in the card that were printed at the factory are sentimental. What you write into the card is an emotion.
Oh, that's a good distinction. I like that.
Right, because the words in the card are never enough.
Good one.
Right. That's that point is, I talk about it in the book, but it's something that's really important to think about as a leader of which one am I really going for here?
Authenticity. I like it. I have three questions I like to ask everybody, so we're going to jump into those. The first one is a place that you have loved to travel to and a place you haven't yet been but would love to go.
I like Japan. I lived there for a while, and I joke that I like Japan because everywhere else I've lived, I've looked in different places in the world. I understood it a little bit more by the time I left. Japan was the opposite. The longer the less I understood it, because it's such a remarkably different place for a Westerner. And so it's a place that to us seems full of contradictions, but that to them are not. And so I found it fascinating to live there. I love going back there. I'm taking my son back from basketball each year, so it's just a place that I find just remarkable. A place that I haven't been to but would love to go is Australia.
Nice.
You're right. Although I come all over the place, I was a consultant, I never made it there. I have a few people who I've coached in Australia through Zoom, and I personally want to put this tough place that I hope one day to make it to there, and or New Zealand. So it's probably the top place that I haven't been to today. I love to see.
Japan and Australia are two places I've not been and are on the top of my list.
There you go. We shared that.
Yes. Perfect. And the second question is, who is a great communicator that you've either known personally or as a public figure?
My very first boss taught me a lot about leadership, and he had three traits I've always tried to emulate and to teach other people. And first of all, he was very good at his job, right? He was technically first rate. So I would say he merited the role. Nobody wondered why he had this job. It's a very technical job. And so he was the expert. We all went to him for answers when we got stuck on something. And so that was one. Two, he led by example. If we're working late, he's working late. In fact, it's working later, right? He's in first, out last. He everything he wanted us to do, he would demonstrate himself and model himself. And so, there was this incredible amount of trust that was built in him because of that. And then the last thing, he over communicated. And so where other people would tell you what they thought you needed to know, he would tell you the whole story, like the background, everything. And I didn't understand why at the time, like, why are you giving us all this detail? And it had two functions I understood much later. One was that he knew within this group, there were future leaders, and he wanted them to understand the big picture. Mm-hmm. I'm out of 10, but one of you is going to replace me one day, and I want you to have the whole picture. And two, when there wasn't time for the whole story, we trusted him again.
Because
we knew that if he had the time, he would have told us. So this great combination of merit the role, right? Lead by example, and then combine with trust the audience, trust your team. It's something that it's not simple, but I can count on one hand the people who I met in my career who had all these traits with equal force, and it was remarkable. He's still maybe the best time to talk to a ever.
Simple and easy are not necessarily the same. There are a lot of things that are simple, but not easy to do.
No, I say, look, running a marathon is simple. Stop running, don't stop for 26 miles. It's not easy.
No.
Simple and hard can go together very well.
So final question is, what is one piece of communication advice you think we can all benefit from?
Think about what must be true in order for any message that you're going to give to work. If you're stuck and something isn't working, take a step back and ask yourself, this message depends on what truth? The example I use is Nike. Well, I studied a bit. And to my knowledge, Nike has never run an ad on the benefits of exercise. Why? Because it's a fundamental truth. The exercise is good for the human body, which underlies every ad they've ever run. And so if you are struggling with a message that seems right, but isn't working, ask yourself, have I assumed that something that is truth that perhaps isn't true? And do I need to address that first? And there are lots of examples from my work where people who are otherwise, again, very accomplished, but the reason they failed is that they assumed that X was true and the audience didn't. And so the chemistry never had a chance to work.
I talk about assumptions all the time. And faulty assumptions are what make just about every miscommunication happen.
It's a critical thing. And sometimes it is just take a minute. And it's ask yourself, okay, this is a very important meeting, a very important presentation, a very important talk or speech or whatever it is. And what, to your point, right? What must be in place to everything about say or show or demonstrate to work? And if you haven't thought about that, if you haven't asked that question, a minute or two doing so can be the difference between success or failure. So.
Wonderful. Carlos, this has been great. How can people learn more about you and or find you online?
You can learn more about me to carlosalvarenga.com. So if you just take my name and you search it, my website will come up and it has everything that I'm writing or working on. You can also reach me through the website and all the interviews and media is also there as well. And you can also reach me on LinkedIn either way.
Wonderful. I'm going to put that in the show notes and make it a little bit easier. Carlos, thank you so much for being here. This has been great.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you for having me, and thank you, everyone, for listening. Have a great day.
Thank you so much for listening to Neuroconversant Leadership. I'm glad you made it this far. If you found this beneficial, can you do me one small favor? Can you give me a review, whether it's on Spotify or Apple or wherever you listen? If you can go and give me a review that you can honestly give, hopefully 5 stars, but if not, I'd rather you be honest. If you can do that for me, I would greatly appreciate it. Thank you so much, and have a great day.